Simon & Schuster Audio presents If It Bleeds by Stephen King. Read by Will Patton, Danny Burstein, and Stephen Weber.
Thinking of Russ Dorr. I miss you, Chief. Mr. Harrigan's phone. My hometown was just a village of 600 or so, and still is, although I have moved away. But we had the internet, just like the big cities, so my father and I got less and less personal mail. Usually, all Mr. Nadeau brought was the weekly copy of Time, flyers addressed to Occupant or Our Friendly Neighbors, and the monthly bills. But starting in 2004, the year I turned 9 and began working for Mr. Harrigan up the hill, I could count on at least 4 envelopes hand-addressed to me each year. There was a Valentine's Day card in February, a birthday card in September, a Thanksgiving Day card in November, and a Christmas card either just before or just after the holiday. Inside each card was a $1 scratch ticket from the Maine State Lottery, and the signature was always the same. Good wishes from Mr. Harrigan. Simple and formal. My father's reaction was always the same, too. A laugh and a good-natured roll of the eyes. "He's a cheapster," Dad said one day. This might have been when I was 11, a couple of years after the cards began arriving. "Pays you cheap wages and gives you a cheap bonus. Lucky devil tickets from Howie's." I pointed out that one of those 4 scratches usually paid off a couple of bucks. When that happened, Dad collected for me at Howie's because minors weren't supposed to play the lottery even if the tickets were freebies. Once, when I hit it big and won $5, I asked Dad to buy me 5 more dollar scratch-offs. He refused, saying if he fed my gambling addiction, my mother would roll over in her grave. "Harrigan doing it is bad enough," Dad said. "Besides, he should be paying you $7 an hour, maybe even 8. God knows he could afford it. 5 an hour may be legal since you're just a kid, but some would consider it child abuse." "I like working for him," I said. "And I like him, Dad." "I understand that," he said. "And it's not like reading to him and weeding his flower garden makes you a 21st century Oliver Twist, but he's still a cheapster. I'm surprised he's willing to spring for postage to mail those cards when it can't be more than a quarter of a mile from his mailbox to ours." We were on our front porch when we had this conversation, drinking glasses of Sprite, and Dad cocked a thumb up our road, dirt, like most of them in Harlow, to Mr. Harrigan's house, which was really a mansion, complete with an indoor pool, a conservatory, a glass elevator that I absolutely loved to ride in, and a greenhouse out back where there used to be a dairy barn. Before my time, but Dad remembered it well. "You know how bad his arthritis is," I said. "Now he uses 2 canes instead of 1 sometimes. Walking down here would about kill him."
"Then he could just hand the damn greeting cards to you," Dad said.
There was no bite to his words. He was mostly just teasing. He and Mr. Harrigan got along all right. My dad got on all right with everyone in Harlow. I suppose that's what made him a good salesman.
"God knows you're up there enough."
"It wouldn't be the same," I said.
"No? Why not?"
I couldn't explain. I had plenty of vocabulary thanks to all the reading I did, but not much life experience. I just knew I liked getting those cards, looked forward to them, and to the lottery ticket I always scratched off with my lucky dime, and to the signature in his old-fashioned cursive, "Good wishes from Mr. Harrigan." Looking back, the word ceremonial comes to mind. It was like how Mr. Harrigan always wore one of his scrawny black ties when he and I drove to town, even though he'd mostly just sit behind the wheel of his sensible Ford sedan reading the Financial Times while I went into the IGA and got the things on his shopping list. There was always corned beef hash on that list, and a dozen eggs. Mr. Harrigan sometimes opined that a man could live perfectly well on eggs and corned beef hash once he had reached a certain age. When I asked him what that age would be, he said 68.
When a man turns 68, he said, he no longer needs vitamins.
Really?
No, he said. I only say that to justify my bad eating habits. Did you or did you not order satellite radio for this car, Craig?
I did. On Dad's home computer because Mr. Harrigan didn't have one.
Then where is it? All I can get is that damn windbag Limbaugh.
I showed him how to get to the XM radio. He turned the knob past 100 or so stations until he found one specializing in country. It was playing Stand By Your Man. That song still gives me the chills, and I suppose it always will. On that day in my 11th year, as my dad and I sat drinking our Sprites and looking up at the big house, which was exactly what Harlowites called it, the big house, as if it were Shawshank Prison, I said, "Getting snail mail is cool." Dad did his eye-roll thing. "Email is cool, and cellular phones. Those things seem like miracles to me. You're too young to understand. If you'd grown up with nothing but a party line and four other houses on it, including Mrs. Edelson, who never shut up, you might feel differently."
"When can I have a cell phone?" This was a question I'd asked a lot that year, more frequently after the first iPhones went on sale.
"When I decide you're old enough."
"Whatever, Dad." It was my turn to roll my eyes, which made him laugh. Then he grew serious.
"Do you understand how rich John Harrigan is?"
I shrugged. "I know he used to own mills."
"He owned a lot more than mills. Until he retired, he was the grand high poobah of a company called Oak Enterprises. He'd owned a shipping line, shopping centers, a chain of movie theaters, a telecom company, I don't know what all else. When it came to the big board, Oak was one of the biggest."
"What's the big board?"
"Stock market. Gambling for rich people. When Harrigan sold out, the deal wasn't just in the business section of the New York Times, it was on the front page. That guy who drives a 6-year-old Ford, lives at the end of a dirt road, pays you $5 an hour, and sends you a dollar scratch ticket 4 times a year, is sitting on better than $1 billion. Dad grinned. "And my worst suit, the one your mother would make me give to the Goodwill if she was still alive, is better than the one he wears to church."
I found all of this interesting. Especially the idea that Mr. Harrigan, who didn't own a laptop or even a TV, had once owned a telecom company and movie theaters. I bet he never even went to the movies. He was what my dad called a Luddite, meaning, among other things, a guy who doesn't like gadgets. The satellite radio was an exception because he liked country music and hated all the ads on WOXO, which was the only C&W station his car radio could pull in.
"Do you know how much a billion is, Craig?"
$100 million, right?
"Try $1,000 million.
"Wow," I said, but only because a wow seemed called for. I understood $5, and I understood $500, the price of a used motor scooter for sale on a deep-cut road that I dreamed of owning, good luck there. And I had a theoretical understanding of $5,000, which was about what my dad made each month as a salesman at Parmalo Tractors and Heavy Machinery in Gates Falls. Dad was always getting his picture on the wall as salesman of the month. He claimed that was no big deal, but I knew better. When he got salesman of the month, we went to dinner at Marcel's, the fancy French restaurant in Castle Rock.
"Wow is right," Dad said, and toasted the big house on the hill with all those rooms that went mostly unused and the elevator Mr. Harrigan loathed but had to use because of his arthritis and sciatica. "Wow is just about goddamn right." Before I tell you about the big money lottery ticket, and Mr. Harrigan dying, and the trouble I had with Kenny Yanko when I was a freshman at Gates Falls High, I should tell you about how I happened to go to work for Mr. Harrigan. It was because of church. Dad and I went to First Methodist of Harlow, which was the only Methodist of Harlow. There used to be another church in town, the one the Baptists used, but it burned down in 1996.
"Some people shoot off fireworks to celebrate the arrival of a new baby," Dad said.
I couldn't have been more than 4 then, but I remember it, probably because fireworks interested me.
Your mom and I said to hell with that and burned down a church to welcome you, Craigster, and what a lovely blaze it made.
Never say that, my mother said. He might believe you and burn one down when he has a kid of his own. They joked a lot together, and I laughed even when I didn't get it. The three of us used to walk to church together, our boots crunching through packed snow in winter, our good shoes puffing up dust in summer, which my mom would wipe off with a Kleenex before we went inside, me always holding Dad's hand on my left, and Mom's on my right. She was a good mom. I still missed her bad in 2004 when I started working for Mr. Harrigan, although she had been dead 3 years then. Now, 16 years later, I still miss her, although her face has faded in my memory, and photos only refresh it a little. What that song says about motherless children is true. They have a hard time. I love my dad, and we always got along fine, but that song's right on another point, too. There's so many things your daddy can't understand, like making a daisy chain and putting it on your head in the big field behind our house and saying today you're not just any little boy, you're King Craig. Like being pleased but not making it out to be a big deal, bragging and all, when you start reading Superman and Spider-Man comic books at the age of 3. Like getting in bed with you if you wake up in the middle of the night from a bad dream where Dr. Octopus is chasing you. Like hugging you and telling you it's okay when some bigger boy, Kenny Yanko, for instance, beats the living shit out of you. I could have used one of those hugs on that day. A mother hug on that day might have changed a lot. Never boasting about being a precocious reader was a gift my parents gave me. The gift of learning early that having some talent doesn't make you better than the next fellow. But word got around, as it always does in small towns, and when I was 8, Reverend Mooney asked me if I would like to read the Bible lesson on Family Sunday. It might have been the novelty of the thing that fetched him. Usually he got a high school boy or girl to do the honors. The reading was from the Book of Mark that Sunday, and after the service, the Rev said I'd done such a good job I could do it every week if I wanted. He says, "A little child shall lead them," I told Dad. "It's in the Book of Isaiah." My father grunted, as if that didn't move him much. Then he nodded. "Fine, as long as you remember you're the medium, not the message." "Huh?" "The Bible is the word of God, not the word of Craig, so don't get a big head about it." I said I wouldn't, and for the next 10 years, until I went off to college where I learned to smoke dope, drink beer, and chase girls, I read the weekly lesson. Even when things were at their very worst, I did that. The Rev would give me the scriptural reference a week in advance, chapter and verse, as the saying is. Then at Methodist Youth Fellowship on Thursday night, I'd bring him a list of the words I couldn't pronounce. As a result, I may be the only person in the state of Maine who can not only pronounce Nebuchadnezzar, but spell it. One of America's richest men moved to Harlow about 3 years before I started my Sunday job of delivering scripture to my elders. The turn of the century, in other words. Right after he sold his companies and retired, and before his big house was even completely finished, the pool, the elevator, and the paved driveway came later. Mr. Harrigan attended church every week, dressed in his rusty black suit with the sagging seat, wearing one of his unfashionably narrow black ties and with his thinning gray hair neatly combed. The rest of the week that hair went every which way, like Einstein's after a busy day of deciphering the cosmos. Back then, he only used one cane, which he leaned on when we rose to sing hymns I suppose I'll remember until the day I die. And that verse of the old rugged cross about water and blood flowing from Jesus' wounded side will always give me chills, just like the last verse of Stand By Your Man when Tammy Wynette goes all out. Anyway, Mr. Harrigan didn't actually sing, which was good because he had kind of a rusty, shrieky voice, but he mouthed along. He and my dad had that in common. One Sunday in the fall of 2004, all the trees in our part of the world burning with color, I read part of 2 Samuel, doing my usual job of imparting to the congregation a message I hardly understood, but knew Reverend Mooney would explain in his sermon. "The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath.
publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. When I sat down in our pew, Dad patted me on the shoulder and whispered, "You said a mouthful," in my ear. I had to cover my mouth to hide a smile. The next evening, as we were finishing up the supper dishes, Dad washing, me drying and putting away, Mr. Harrigan's Ford pulled into the driveway. His cane thumped up our dooryard steps, and Dad opened the door just before he could knock. Mr. Harrigan declined the living room and sat at the kitchen table just like home folks. He accepted a Sprite when Dad offered, but declined a glass. "I take it from the bottle, the way my pa did," he said. He got right to the point, being a man of business. If my father approved, Mr. Harrigan said he'd like to hire me to read to him 2 or perhaps 3 hours a week. For this, he would pay $5 an hour. He could offer another 3 hours' worth of work, he said, if I would tend his garden a bit and do some other chores, such as snow shoveling, the steps in winter, and dusting what needed dusting year-round. $25, maybe even $30 a week. Half of it just for reading, which was something I would have done for free. I couldn't believe it. Thoughts of saving up for a motor scooter immediately rose to mind, even though I would not be able to ride one legally for another 7 years. It was too good to be true, and I was afraid my father would say no, but he didn't. "Just don't give him anything controversial," Dad said. "No crazy political stuff and no overboard violence. He reads like a grown-up, but he's just 9, and barely that." Mr. Harrigan gave him this promise, drank some of his Sprite, and smacked his leathery lips.
"He reads well, yes, but that's not the main reason I want to hire him. He doesn't drone, even when he doesn't understand. I find that remarkable. Not amazing, but remarkable."
He put his bottle down and leaned forward, fixing me with his sharp gaze. I often saw amusement in those eyes, but only seldom did I see warmth. And that night in 2004 wasn't one of them.
"How about your reading yesterday, Craig? Do you know what is meant by the daughters of the uncircumcised?"
"Not really," I said.
"I didn't think so. But you still got the right tone of anger and lamentation in your voice. You know what lamentation is, by the way?"
"Crying and stuff." He nodded.
"But you didn't overdo it. You didn't ham it up. That was good. A reader is a carrier, not a creator. Does Reverend Mooney help you with your pronunciation?"
"Yes, sir, sometimes."
Mr. Harrigan drank some more Sprite and rose, leaning on his cane. "Tell him it's Ashkelon, not Ascalon. I found that unintentionally funny, but I have a very low sense of humor. Shall we have a trial run Wednesday at 3? Are you out of school by then?"
"I got out of Harlow Elementary at 2:30. "Yes, sir. 3 would be fine."
"Shall we say until 4, or is that too late?"
"That works," Dad said. He sounded bemused by the whole thing. "We don't eat until 6. I like to watch the local news."
"Doesn't that play hell with your digestion?"
Dad laughed, although I don't really think Mr. Harrigan was joking. "Sometimes it does. I'm not a fan of Mr. Bush."
"He is a bit of a fool," Mr. Harrigan agreed. "But at least he surrounded himself with men who understand business. 3 on Wednesday, Craig. And don't be late. I have no patience with tardiness."
"Nothing risque either," Dad said. "Time enough for that when he's older." Mr. Harrigan also promised this. But I suppose men who understand business also understand that promises are easy to discard, being as how giving them is free. There was certainly nothing risque in Heart of Darkness, which was the first book I read for him. When we finished, Mr. Harrigan asked me if I understood it. I don't think he was trying to tutor me. He was just curious. "Not a whole lot," I said. "But that guy Kurtz was pretty crazy. I got that much." There was nothing risque in the next book, either. Silas Marner was just a bore-a-thon, in my humble opinion. The third one, however, was Lady Chatterley's Lover, and that was certainly an eye-opener. It was 2006 when I was introduced to Constance Chatterley and her Randy Gamekeeper. I was 10. All these years later, I can still remember the verses of The Old Rugged Cross, and just as vividly recall Mellers stroking the lady and murmuring, "Thart nice." How he treated her is a good thing for boys to learn, and a good thing to remember.
"Do you understand what you just read?" Mr. Harrigan asked me after one particularly steamy passage. Again, just curious.
"No," I said, "but that wasn't strictly true. I understood a lot more of what was going on between Ollie Mellers and Connie Chatterley in the woods than I did about what was going on between Marlowe and Kurtz down there in the Belgian Congo. Sex is hard to figure out, something I learned even before I got to college, but crazy is even harder."
"Fine," Mr. Harrigan said. "But if your father asks what we're reading, I suggest you tell him Dombey and Son, which we're going to read next anyway."
My father never did ask about that one anyway, and I was relieved when we moved on to Dombey, which was the first adult novel I remember really liking. I didn't want to lie to my dad. It would have made me feel horrible, although I'm sure Mr. Harrigan would have had no problem with it. Mr. Harrigan liked me to read to him because his eyes tired easily. He probably didn't need me to weed his flowers. Pete Bostwick, who mowed his acre or so of lawn, would have been happy to do that, I think. And Edna Grogan, his housekeeper, would have been happy to dust his large collection of antique snow globes and glass paperweights, but that was my job. He mostly just liked having me around. He never told me that until shortly before he died. But I knew it. I just didn't know why, and I'm not sure I do now. Once, when we were coming back from dinner at Marcel's in the Rock, my dad said very abruptly, "Does Harrigan ever touch you in a way you don't like?" I was years from even being able to grow a shadow mustache, but I knew what he was asking. We had learned about stranger danger and inappropriate touching in the third grade, for God's sake. "Do you mean, does he grope me?" "No! Jeez, Dad, he's not gay!" "All right, don't get all mad about it, Craigster. I had to ask, because you're up there a lot. If he was groping me, he could at least send me $2 scratch tickets," I said, and that made Dad laugh. $30 a week was about what I made, and Dad insisted I put at least 20 of it in my college savings account, which I did, although I considered it mega stupid. When even being a teenager seems an age away, college might as well be in another lifetime. $10 a week was still a fortune. I spent some of it on burgers and shakes at the Howie's Market lunch counter, most of it on old paperbacks at Dolly's Used Books in Gates Falls. The ones I bought weren't heavy going, like the ones I read to Mr. Harrigan. Even Lady Chatterley was heavy when Constance and Mellers weren't steaming the place up. I liked crime novels and westerns like Shootout at Gila Bend and Hot Lead Trail. Reading to Mr. Harrigan was work. Not sweat labor, but work. A book like One Monday We Killed Them All by John D. MacDonald was pure pleasure. I told myself I ought to save up the money that didn't go into the college fund for one of the new Apple phones that went on sale in the summer of 2007, but they were expensive, like $600, and at $10 a week that would take me over a year. And when you're just 11, going on 12, a year is a very long time. Besides, those old paperbacks with their colorful covers called to me. On Christmas morning of 2007, 3 years after I started working for Mr. Harrigan and 2 years before he died, there was only one package for me under the tree, and my dad told me to save it for last after he had duly admired the paisley vest, the slippers, and the briar pipe I'd gotten him. With that out of the way, I tore off the wrappings on my one present and shrieked with delight when I saw he'd gotten me exactly what I'd been lusting for, an iPhone that did so many different things that it made my father's car phone look like an antique. Things have changed a lot since then. Now it's the iPhone my father gave me for Christmas in 2007 that's the antique, like the 5-family party line he told me about from back when he was a kid. There's been so many changes, so many advances, and they happened so fast. My Christmas iPhone had just 16 apps, and they came preloaded. One of them was YouTube, because back then Apple and YouTube were friends. That changed. One was called SMS, which was primitive text messaging. No emojis, a word not yet invented, unless you made them yourself. There was a weather app that was usually wrong, but you could make phone calls from something small enough to carry in your hip pocket, and even better, there was Safari, which linked you to the outside world. When you grew up in a no-stoplight dirt road town like Harlow, the outside world was a strange and tempting place, and you longed to touch it in a way network TV couldn't match. At least I did. All these things were at your fingertips, courtesy of AT&T and Steve Jobs. There was another app as well, one that made me think of Mr. Harrigan even on that first joyful morning. Something much cooler than the satellite radio in his car, at least for guys like him. "Thanks, Dad," I said and hugged him. "Thank you so much." "Just don't overuse it. The phone charges are sky high and I'll be keeping track." "They'll come down," I said. I was right about that, and Dad never gave me a hard time about the charges. I didn't have many people to call anyway, but I did like those YouTube videos. Dad did too. And I loved being able to go on what we then called the 3 W's, the World Wide Web. Sometimes I would look at articles in Pravda, not because I understood Russian, but just because I could. Not quite 2 months later, I came home from school, opened the mailbox, and found an envelope addressed to me in Mr. Harrigan's old-fashioned script. It was my Valentine's Day card. I went into the house, dropped my school books on the table, and opened it. The card wasn't flowery or sappy, that wasn't Mr. Harrigan's style. It showed a man in a tuxedo holding out a top hat and bowing in a field of flowers. The hallmark message inside said, "May you have a year filled with love and friendship." Below that, "Good wishes from Mr. Harrigan." A bowing man with his hat held out, a good wish, and no sticky stuff. That was Mr. Harrigan all over. Looking back, I'm surprised he considered Valentine's Day worth a card. In 2008, the Lucky Devil $1 scratches had been replaced by ones called Pine Tree Cash. There were 6 pine trees on the little card. If the same amount was beneath 3 of them when you scratched them off, you won that amount. I scratched away the trees and stared at what I'd uncovered. At first, I thought it was either a mistake or some kind of joke, although Mr. Harrigan was not the joke-playing type. I looked again, running my fingers along the uncovered numbers, brushing away crumbles of what my dad called, always with the eye roll, scratch dirt. The numbers stayed the same. I might have laughed. That I can't recall. But I remember screaming, all right. Screaming for joy. I grabbed my new phone out of my pocket. That phone went everywhere with me, and called Parmelo Tractors. I got Denise, the receptionist, and when she heard how out of breath I was, she asked me what was wrong. "Nothing, nothing," I said, "but I have to talk to my dad right now." "All right, just hold on." And then, "You sound like you're calling from the other side of the moon, Craig." "I'm on my cell phone." God, I loved saying that. Denise made a humph sound. "Those things are full of radiation. I'd never own one. Hold on." My dad also asked me what was wrong because I'd never called him at work before, even on the day the school bus left without me. "Dad, I got my Valentine's Day scratch ticket from Mr. Harrigan." "If you called to tell me you won $10, it could have waited until I..." "No, Daddy, it's the big prize." Which it was, for dollar scratch-offs back then. "I won $3,000. Silence from the other end of the line. I thought maybe I'd lost him. In those days, cell phones, even the new ones, dropped calls all the time. Ma Bell wasn't always the best mother. "Dad, are you still there?" "Uh-huh. Are you sure?" "Yes, I'm looking right at it. 3 3,000s. 1 in the top row and 2 in the bottom." Another long pause. Then I heard my father telling someone, "I think my kid won some money." A moment later, he was back to me. "Put it somewhere safe until I get home." "Where?" "How about the sugar canister in the pantry?" "Yeah," I said. "Yeah, okay." "Craig, are you positive? I don't want you to be disappointed, so check again." I did, somehow convinced that my dad's doubt would change what I had seen. At least one of those 3,000s would now be something else, but they were the same. I told him that, and he laughed. "Well, then, congratulations. Marcel's tonight, and you're buying." That made me laugh. I can't remember ever feeling such pure joy. I needed to call someone else, so I called Mr. Harrigan, who answered on his Luddite landline. "Mr. Harrigan, thank you for the card, and thank you for the ticket. I..." "Are you calling on that gadget of yours?" he asked.
You must be, because I can barely hear you. You sound like you're on the other side of the moon.
Mr. Harrigan, I won the big prize. I won $3,000. Thank you so much.
There was a pause, but not as long as my father's, and when he spoke again, he didn't ask me if I was sure. He did me that courtesy.
You struck lucky, he said. Good for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome, but thanks really aren't necessary. I buy those things by the roll. Send them off to friends and business acquaintances as a kind of, calling card, you could say. Been doing it for years. One was bound to pay off big sooner or later.
Dad will make me put most of it in the bank. I guess that's okay. It will certainly perk up my college fund.
Give it to me if you like, Mr. Harrigan said. Let me invest it for you. I think I can guarantee a better return than bank interest.
Then speaking more to himself than to me.
Something very safe. This isn't going to be a good year for the market. I see clouds on the horizon.
Sure, I reconsidered. At least probably. I have to talk to my dad.
Of course, only proper. Tell him I'm willing to also guarantee the base sum. Are you still coming to read for me this afternoon? Or you put that aside now that you're a man of means?
Sure, only I have to be back when Dad gets home. We're going out to dinner, I paused. Would you like to come?
Not tonight, he said with no hesitation. You know, you could have told me all of this in person since you're coming up anyway. But you enjoy that gadget of yours, don't you?
He didn't wait for me to answer that. He didn't need to.
What would you think of investing your little windfall in Apple stock? I believe that company is going to be quite successful in the future. I'm hearing the iPhone is going to bury the BlackBerry. Pardon the pun. In any case, don't answer now. Discuss it with your father first.
I will, I said, and I'll be right up. I'll run.
Youth is a wonderful thing, said Mr. Harrigan. What a shame it's wasted on children.
Huh?
Many have said it, but Shaw said it best. Never mind. Run, by all means. Run like the Dickens, because Dickens awaits us.
I ran the quarter of a mile to Mr. Harrigan's house, but walked back. And on the way, I had an idea. A way to thank him, even though he said no thanks were necessary. Over our fancy dinner at Marcel's that night, I told Dad about Mr. Harrigan's offer to invest my windfall, and I also told him my idea for a thank you gift. I thought Dad would have his doubts, and I was right. By all means, let him invest the money. As for your idea, you know how he feels about stuff like that. He's not only the richest man in Harlow, in the whole state of Maine, for that matter. He's also the only one who doesn't have a television. He's got an elevator, I said, and he uses it. Because he has to. Then Dad gave me a grin. But it's your money, and if this is what you want to do with 20% of it, I'm not going to tell you no. When he turns it down, you can give it to me.
You really think he will?
I do.
Dad, why did he come here in the first place? I mean, we're just a little town. We're nowhere.
Good question. Ask him sometime. Now what about some dessert, Big Spender? Just about a month later, I gave Mr. Harrigan a brand new iPhone. I didn't wrap it up or anything, partly because it wasn't a holiday and partly because I knew how he liked things done with no foo-farah. He turned the box over a time or two in his arthritis-gnarled hands, looking bemused. Then he held it out to me.
Thank you, Craig. I appreciate the sentiment. But no, I suggest you give it to your father.
I took the box. He told me you'd say that. I was disappointed but not surprised, and not ready to give up.
Your father is a wise man.
He leaned forward in his chair and clasped his hands between his spread knees.
Craig, I rarely give advice. It's almost always a waste of breath, but today I'll give some to you. Henry Thoreau said that we don't own things. Things own us. Every new object, whether it's a home, a car, a television, or a fancy phone like that one, is something more we must carry on our backs. It makes me think of Jacob Marley telling Scrooge, "These are the chains I forged in life." I don't have a television because if I did, I would watch it, even though almost all of what it broadcasts is utter nonsense. I don't have a radio in the house because I would listen to it, and a little country music to break the monotony of a long drive is really all I require. If I had that,
he pointed to the box with the phone inside, I would undoubtedly use it. I get 12 different periodicals in the mail, and they contain all the information I need to keep up with the business world and the wider world's sad doings. He sat back and sighed. There. I've not only given advice, I've made a speech. Old age is insidious.
Can I show you just one thing? No, two. He gave me one of the looks I'd seen him give his gardener and his housekeeper, but had never turned my way until that afternoon. Piercing, skeptical, and rather ugly. These years later, I realize it's the look a perceptive and cynical man gives when he believes he can see inside most people and expects to find nothing good.
This only proves the old saying that no good deed goes unpunished. I'm starting to wish that scratch ticket hadn't been a winner. He sighed again. Well, go ahead, give me your demonstration, but you won't change my mind.
Having received that look, so distant and so cold, I thought he was right. I'd end up giving the phone to my father after all, but since I'd come this far, I went ahead. The phone was charged to the max, I'd made sure of that, and was in, ha-ha, apple pie working order. I turned it on and showed him an icon in the second row. It had jagged lines, sort of like an EKG printout. See that one?
Yes. And I see what it says, but I really don't need a stock market report, Greg. I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, as you know.
Sure, I agreed, but the Wall Street Journal can't do this. I tapped the icon and opened the app. The Dow Jones average appeared. I had no idea what the numbers meant, but I could see they were fluctuating. 14,720 rose to 14,728. Then dropped to 14,704, then bumped up to 14,716. Mr. Harrigan's eyes widened. His mouth dropped open. It was as if someone had hit him with a juju stick. He took the phone and held it close to his face. Then he looked at me.
Are these numbers in real time?
Yes, I said. Well, I guess they might be a minute or two behind. I don't know for sure. The phone's pulling them in from the new phone tower in Motton. We're lucky to have one so close. He leaned forward. A reluctant smile touched the corners of his mouth.
I'll be damned. It's like the stock ticker's magnets used to have in their own homes.
Oh, way better than that, I said. Tickers sometimes ran hours behind. My dad said that just last night. He's fascinated with this stock market thingy. He's always taken my phone to look. He said one of the reasons the stock market tanked so bad back in 1929 was because the more people traded, the farther behind the tickers got.
He's right, Mr. Harrigan said. Things had gone too far before anyone could put on the brakes. Of course, something like this might actually accelerate a sell-off. It's hard to tell because the technology is still so new.
I waited. I wanted to tell him some more, sell him on it. I was just a kid, after all. But something told me waiting was the right way to go. He continued to watch the minuscule gyrations of the Dow Jones. He was getting an education right in front of my eyes.
But,
he said, still staring. But what, Mr. Harrigan?
In the hands of someone who actually knows the market, something like this could... probably already does.
He trailed off, thinking. Then he said,
I should have known about this. Being retired is no excuse.
Here's the other thing, I said, too impatient to wait any longer. You know all the magazines you get? Newsweek and Financial Times and Forbes?
Forbes,
he said, still watching the screen. He reminded me of me at four studying the magic eight ball I'd gotten for my birthday. Yeah, that one. Can I have the phone for a minute? He handed it over rather reluctantly, and I was pretty sure I had him after all. I was glad, but I also felt a little ashamed of myself. Like a guy who's just clonked a tame squirrel on the head when it came up to take a nut out of his hand. I opened Safari. It was a lot more primitive than it is today, but it worked just fine. I poked Wall Street Journal into the Google search field, and after a few seconds, the front page opened up. One of the headlines read, Coffee Cow Announces Closings. I showed it to him. He stared, then took the newspaper from the table beside the easy chair where I'd put his mail when I came in. He looked at the front page.
"That isn't here," he said.
"Because it's yesterday's," I said. I always got the mail out of his box when I came up, and the journal was always wrapped around the other stuff and held with a rubber band. "You get it a day late. Everybody does. And during the holiday season, it came 2 days late, sometimes three. I didn't need to tell him this. He grumbled about it constantly during November and December."
"This is today's?"
he asked, looking at the screen, then checking the date at the top.
"It is."
"Sure," I said. "Fresh news instead of stale, right?"
"According to this, there's a map of the closing sites. Can you show me how to get it?"
He sounded positively greedy. I was a little scared. He had mentioned Scrooge and Marley. I felt like Mickey Mouse in Fantasia using a spell he didn't really understand to wake up the brooms. "You can do it yourself. Just brush the screen with your finger like this." I showed him. At first he brushed too hard and went too far, but he got the knack of it after that. Faster than my dad, actually. He found the right page.
"Look at that," he marveled. 600 stores. You see what I was telling you about the fragility of the..."
He trailed off, staring at the tiny map.
"The South. Most of the closures are in the South. The South is a bellwether, Craig. It almost always..." "I think I need to make a call to New York. The market will be closing soon."
He started to get up. His regular phone was on the other side of the room. "You can call from this," I said. "It's mostly what it's for." It was then, anyway. I pushed the phone icon, and the keypad appeared. "Just dial the number you want. Touch the keys with your finger." He looked at me, blue eyes bright beneath his shaggy white brows.
"I can do that out here, in the Willy Wags?"
"Yeah," I said. "The reception is terrific, thanks to the new tower. You've got 4 bars."
"Bars?"
"Never mind. Just make your call. I'll leave you alone while you do it. Just wave out the window when you're..."
"No need. This won't take long, and I don't need privacy."
He touched the numbers tentatively, as if he expected to set off an explosion. Then just as tentatively, he raised the iPhone to his ear, looking at me for confirmation. I nodded, encouragingly. He listened, spoke to someone too loud at first, and then after a short wait, to someone else. So I was right there when Mr. Harrigan sold all of his Coffee Cal stock, a transaction amounting to who knows how many thousands of dollars. When he was finished, he figured out how to go back to the home screen. From there, he opened Safari again.
"Is Forbes on here?"
I checked. It wasn't. "But if you're looking for an article from Forbes you already know about, you can probably find it because someone will have posted it."
"Posted?"
"Yeah, and if you want info about something, Safari will search for it. You just have to Google it. Look." I went over to his chair and entered Coffee Cal in the search field. The phone considered, then spewed a number of hits, including the Wall Street Journal article he'd called his broker about.
"Will you look at this?" he marveled. "It's the Internet."
"Well, yeah," I said, thinking, well, duh.
"The World Wide Web."
"Yeah."
"Which has been around how long?"
"You should know this stuff," I thought. "You're a big businessman. You should know this stuff even if you're retired, because you're still interested." "I don't know exactly how long it's been around, but people are on it all the time. My dad, my teachers, the cops, everyone, really." More pointedly, "including your companies, Mr. Harrigan."
"Ah, but they're not mine anymore. I do know a little, Craig, as I know a little about various television shows, even though I don't watch television. I have a tendency to skip the technology articles in my newspapers and magazines because I have no interest. If you wanted to talk bowling alleys or film distribution networks, that would be a different matter. I keep my hand in, so to speak."
"Yeah, but don't you see? Those businesses are using the technology, and if you don't understand it..." I didn't know how to finish, at least without straying beyond the bounds of politeness, but it seemed he did.
"I will be left behind. That's what you're saying."
"I guess it doesn't matter," I said. "Hey, you're retired, after all."
"But I don't want to be considered a fool."
he said, and rather vehemently. "Do you think Chick Rafferty was surprised when I called and told him to sell Coffee Cow? Not at all, because he's undoubtedly had half a dozen other major clients pick up the phone and tell him to do the same. Some are no doubt people with inside information. Others, though, just happen to live in New York or New Jersey and get the journal on the day it's published and find out that way, unlike me, stashed away up here in God's country."
I again wondered why he'd come to begin with. He certainly had no relatives in town, but this didn't seem like the time to ask.
"I may have been arrogant."
He brooded on this, then actually smiled, which was like watching the sun break through heavy cloud cover on a cold day.
"I have been arrogant."
He raised the iPhone.
"I'm going to keep this after all."
The first thing that rose to my lips was, "Thank you," which would have been weird. I just said, "Good, I'm glad." He glanced at the Seth Thomas on the wall, and then I was amused to see, checked it against the time on the iPhone.
"Why don't we just read a single chapter today, since we spent so much time talking?"
"Fine with me," I said, although I would gladly have stayed longer and read two or even three chapters. We were getting near the end of The Octopus by a guy named Frank Norris, and I was anxious to see how things turned out. It was an old-fashioned novel, but full of exciting stuff just the same. When we finished the shortened session, I watered Mr. Harrigan's few indoor plants. This was always my last chore of the day and only took a few minutes. While I did it, I saw him playing with the phone, turning it on and off.
"I suppose if I'm going to use this thing, you better show me how to use it," he said. "How to keep it from going dead, to start with. The charge is already dropping, I see."
"You'll be able to figure most of it out on your own," I said. "It's pretty easy. As for charging it, there's a cord in the box. You just plug it into the wall. I can show you a few other things if you..."
"Not today," he said. "Tomorrow, perhaps."
"Okay."
"One more question, though. Why could I read that article about Coffee Cow and look at that map of proposed closing sites?"
The first thing that came to mind was Hillary's answer about climbing Mount Everest, which we had just read about in school. "Because it's there." But he might have seen that as smartass, which it sort of was, so I said, "I don't get you."
"Really? A bright boy like you? Think, Craig, think. I just read something for free that people pay good money for. Even with the journal subscription rate, which is a good deal cheaper than buying off a newsstand, I pay 90 cents or so an issue. And yet, with this..."
He held up the phone just as thousands of kids would hold theirs up at rock concerts not many years later.
"Now do you understand?"
When he put it that way, I sure did, but I had no answer. It sounded...
"Sounds stupid, doesn't it?"
he asked, reading either my face or my mind.
"Giving away useful information runs counter to everything I understand about successful business practices."
"Maybe..."
"Maybe what? Give me your insights. I'm not being sarcastic. You clearly know more about this than I do, so tell me what you're thinking."
"I was thinking about the Freiburg Fair, where Dad and I went once or twice every October. We usually took my friend Margie from down the road. Margie and I rode the rides. Then all three of us ate doughboys and sweet sausages before Dad dragged us to look at the new tractors. To get to the equipment sheds, you had to go past the Beano tent, which was enormous. I told Mr. Harrigan about the guy out front with the microphone, telling the passing folks how you always got the first game for free." He considered this.
"A come on? I suppose that makes a degree of sense. You're saying you can only look at one article, maybe two or three, and then the machine, what, shuts you out? Tells you if you want to play, you have to pay?"
"No," I admitted. "I guess it's not like the Beano tent after all, because you can look at as many as you want, at least as far as I know."
"But that's crazy. Giving away a free sample is one thing, but giving away the store..."
He snorted.
"There wasn't even an advertisement. Did you notice that? And advertising is a huge income stream for newspapers and periodicals. Huge."
He picked the phone up, stared at his reflection in the now blank screen, then put it down and peered at me with a queer, sour smile on his face.
We may be looking at a huge mistake here, Craig. One being made by people who understand the practical aspects of a thing like this, the ramifications, no more than I do. An economic earthquake may be coming. For all I know, it's already here. An earthquake that's going to change how we get our information, when we get it, where we get it, and hence how we look at the world. He paused. And deal with it, of course.
You lost me, I said.
Look at it this way. If you get a puppy, you have to teach him to do his business outside, right?
Right.
If you had a puppy that wasn't housebroken, would you give him a treat for shitting in the living room?
Course not, I said.
He nodded. It would be teaching him the exact opposite of what you want him to learn. And when it comes to commerce, Craig, most people are like puppies that need to be housebroken.
I didn't much like that concept, and don't today. I think the punishment-reward thing says a lot about how Mr. Harrigan made his fortune, but I kept my mouth shut. I was seeing him in a new way. He was like an old explorer on a new voyage of discovery, and listening to him was fascinating. I don't think he was really trying to teach me either. He was learning himself, and for a guy in his mid-80s, he was learning fast.
Free samples are fine, but if you give people too much for free, whether it's clothes or food or information, they come to expect it. Like puppies that crap on the floor and then look you in the eye, and what they're thinking is, you taught me this was all right. If I were the Wall Street Journal, or the Times, even the damn Reader's Digest, I'd be very frightened by this, Gizmo.
He picked up the iPhone again. Couldn't seem to leave it alone.
It's like a broken water main, one spewing information instead of water. I thought it was just a phone we were talking about, but now I see, or begin to see.
He shook his head as if to clear it.
Craig, what if someone with proprietary information about new drugs in development decided to put the test results out on this thing for the whole world to read? It could cost Upjohn or Unichem millions of dollars. Or suppose some disaffected person decided to spill government secrets.
Wouldn't they be arrested?
Maybe. Probably. But once the toothpaste is out of the tube, as they say, ay-yay-yay. Well, never mind. You better go home or you'll be late for supper.
On my way.
Thank you again for the gift. I probably won't use it very much, but I intend to think about it. As hard as I'm able, at least. My brains aren't as nimble as they once were.
I think they're still plenty nimble, I said, and I wasn't just buttering him up. Why weren't there ads along with the news stories and YouTube videos? People would have to look at them, right? Besides, my dad says it's a thought that counts.
An aphorism more often spoken than adhered to, he said, and when he saw my puzzled expression, never mind. I'll see you tomorrow, Craig.
On my walk back down the hill, kicking up clouds of that year's last snow, I thought about what he'd said, that the internet was like a broken water main spewing information instead of water. It was true of my dad's laptop as well, and the computers at the school, and ones all over the country. The world, really. Although the iPhone was still so new to him he could barely figure out how to turn it on, Mr. Harrigan already understood the need to fix the broken pipe if business, as he knew it anyway, was going to continue as it always had. I'm not sure, but I think he foresaw paywalls a year or two before the term was even coined. Certainly I didn't know it then, no more than I knew how to get around restricted operations, what came to be known as jailbreaking. Paywalls came, but by then people had gotten used to getting stuff for free, and they resented being asked to cough up. People faced with a New York Times paywall went to a site like CNN or Huffington Post instead, usually in a huff, even though the reporting wasn't as good. Unless, of course, you wanted to learn about a fashion development known as side boob. Mr. Harrigan was totally right about that. After dinner that night, once the dishes were washed and put away, my dad opened his laptop on the table. "I found something new," he said. "It's a site called previews.com where you can watch coming attractions."
"Really? Let's see some."
So for the next half hour,
We watched movie trailers we would otherwise have had to go to a movie theater to see. Mr. Harrigan would have torn his hair out, what little he had left. Walking back from Mr. Harrigan's house on that March day in 2008, I was pretty sure he was wrong about one thing. "I probably won't use it very much," he'd said, but I had noted the look on his face as he stared at the map showing the Coffee Cow closings, and how quickly he'd used his new phone to call someone in New York. His combination lawyer and business manager, I found out later, not his broker. And I was correct. Mr. Harrigan used that phone plenty. He was like the old maiden aunt who takes an experimental mouthful of brandy after 60 years of abstinence and becomes a genteel alcoholic almost overnight. Before long, the iPhone was always on the table beside his favorite chair when I came up in the afternoon. God knows how many people he called. But I know he called me almost every night to ask me some question or other about his new acquisition's capabilities. Once he said it was like an old-fashioned roll-top desk, full of small drawers and caches and cubbyholes it was easy to overlook. He found most of the caches and cubbyholes himself with aid from various internet sources, but I helped him out, enabled him, you might say, at the start. When he told me he hated the prissy little xylophone that sounded off when he had an incoming call, I changed it to a snatch of Tammy Wynette, singing Stand By Your Man. Mr. Harrigan thought that was a hoot. I showed him how to set the phone on silent so it wouldn't disturb him when he took his afternoon nap, how to set the alarm, and how to record a message for when he didn't feel like answering. His was a model of brevity. "I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate." He began unplugging his landline when he went for his daily snooze, and I noticed he was leaving it unplugged more and more. He sent me text messages which 10 years ago we called IMs. He took phone photos of mushrooms in the field behind his house and sent them off via email to be identified. He kept notes in the note function and discovered videos of his favorite country artists.
"I wasted an hour of beautiful summer daylight this morning watching George Jones videos," he told me later on that year, with a mixture of shame and a weird kind of pride.
I asked him once why he didn't go out and buy his own laptop. He'd be able to do all the things he'd learned to do on his phone, and on the bigger screen he could see Porter Wagner in all his bejeweled glory. Mr. Harrigan just shook his head and laughed.
"Get thee behind me, Satan. It's like you taught me to smoke marijuana and enjoy it, and now you're saying if you like pot, you'll really like heroin. I think not, Craig. This is enough for me."
And he patted the phone affectionately the way you might pat a small sleeping animal. A puppy, say, that's finally been housebroken. We read They Shoot Horses, Don't They, in the fall of 2008. And when Mr. Harrigan called a halt early one afternoon, he said all those dance marathons were exhausting, we went into the kitchen where Mrs. Grogan had left a plate of oatmeal cookies. Mr. Harrigan walked slowly, stumping along on his canes. I walked behind him, hoping I'd be able to catch him if he fell. He sat with a grunt and a grimace and took one of the cookies.
"Good old Edna," he said. "I love these sinks, and they always get my bowels in gear. Get us each a glass of milk, will you, Craig?"
As I was getting it, the question I kept forgetting to ask him recurred. "Why did you move here, Mr. Harrigan? You could live anywhere." He took his glass of milk and made a toasting gesture, as he always did, and I made one right back, as I always did.
"Where would you live, Craig, if you could, as you say, live anywhere?"
"Maybe Los Angeles, where they make the movies. I could catch on hauling equipment and work my way up." Then I told him a great secret. "Maybe I could write for the movies." I thought he might laugh, but he didn't.
"Well, I suppose someone asked him. Why not you? And would you never long for home? To see your father's face or put flowers on your mother's grave?"
"Oh, I'd come back," I said, but the question and the mention of my mother gave me pause.
"I wanted a clean break," Mr. Harrigan said. "As someone who lived his whole life in a city, I grew up in Brooklyn before it became a, I don't know, kind of potted plant. I wanted to get away from New York in my final years. I wanted to live somewhere in the country, but not the tourist country. places like Camden and Castine and Bar Harbor. I wanted a place where the roads were still unpaved.
Well, I said, you sure came to the right place. He laughed and took another cookie.
I considered the Dakotas, you know, and Nebraska, but ultimately decided that was taking things too far. I had my assistant bring me pictures of a good many towns in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, and this was the place I settled on, because of the hill. There are views in every direction, but not spectacular views. Spectacular views might bring tourists, which was exactly what I didn't want. I like it here. I like the peace. I like the neighbors. And I like you, Craig.
That made me happy.
There's something else. I don't know how much you've read about my working life, but if you have, or do in the future, you'll find many of the opinion that I was ruthless as I climbed what envious and intellectually clueless people call the ladder of success. That opinion isn't entirely wrong. I made enemies, I freely admitted. Business is like football, Craig. If you have to knock someone down to reach the goal line, you better damn well do it or you shouldn't put on a uniform and go out in the field in the first place. But when a game is over, and mine is, although I keep my hand in, you take off the uniform and go home. This is now home for me. This unremarkable corner of America with its single store and its school, which will, I believe, soon be closing. People no longer just drop by for a drink. I don't have to attend business lunches with people who always, always want something. I am not invited to take a seat at board meetings. I don't have to go to charity functions that bore me to tears. And I don't have to wake up at 5 in the morning to the sound of garbage trucks loading on 81st Street. I'll be buried here, in Elm Cemetery, among the Civil War veterans, and I won't have to pull rank or bribe some superintendent of graves for a nice plot. Does any of that explain?
It did, and didn't. He was a mystery to me, to the very end and even beyond. But maybe that's always true. I think we mostly live alone, by choice, like him, or just because that's the way the world was made. Sort of, I said. At least you didn't move to North Dakota. I'm glad of that. He smiled.
So am I. Take another cookie to eat on your way home and say hello to your father.
With a diminishing tax base that could no longer support it, our little six-room Harlow school did close in June of 2009, and I found myself facing the prospect of attending eighth grade across the Androscoggin River at Gates Falls Middle, with over 70 classmates instead of just 12. That was the summer I kissed a girl for the first time. Not Margie, but her best friend Regina. It was also the summer that Mr. Harrigan died. I was the one who found him. I knew he was having a harder and harder job getting around, and I knew he was losing his breath more often, sometimes sucking from the oxygen bottle he now kept beside his favorite chair. But other than those things, which I just accepted, there was no warning. The day before was like any other. I read a couple of chapters from McTeague. I had asked if we could read another Frank Norris book, and Mr. Harrigan was agreeable, and watered his houseplants while Mr. Harrigan scrolled through his emails. He looked up at me and said,
"People are catching on."
"To what?"
He held up his phone. "To this, what it really means, to what it can do. Archimedes said, give me a lever long enough and I will move the world. This is that lever."
"Cool," I said.
"I have just deleted 3 ads for products and almost 12 political solicitations. I have no doubt my email address is being bandied about just as magazines sell the addresses of their subscribers."
"Good thing they don't know who you are," I said. Mr. Harrigan's email handle, he loved having a handle, was Pirate King One.
"If someone is keeping track of my searches, they don't have to. They'll be able to suss out my interests and solicit me accordingly. My name means nothing to them. My interests do."
"Yeah, spam is annoying," I said, and went into the kitchen to dump the watering can and put it in the mudroom. When I came back, Mr. Harrigan had the oxygen mask over his mouth and nose and was taking deep breaths. "Did you get that from your doctor?" I asked. "Did he, like, prescribe it?" He lowered it and said,
"I don't have a doctor. Men in their mid-80s can eat all the corned beef hash they want, and they no longer need doctors unless they have cancer. Then a doctor is handy to prescribe pain medication."
His mind was somewhere else.
"Have you considered Amazon, Craig? The company, not the river."
Dad bought stuff from Amazon sometimes, but no, I'd never really considered it. I told Mr. Harrigan that and asked what he meant. He pointed to the modern library copy of McTeague.
"This came from Amazon. I ordered it with my phone and my credit card. That company used to be just books, a little more than a mom-and-pop operation, really, but soon it may be one of the biggest and most powerful corporations in America. Their smile logo will be as ubiquitous as the Chevrolet emblem on cars or this on our phones."
He lifted his, showing me the apple with the bite out of it.
"Is spam annoying? Yes. Is it becoming a cockroach of American commerce, breeding and scurrying everywhere? Yes, because spam works, Craig. It pulls the plow. And in a not-too-distant future, spam may decide elections. If I were a younger man, I'd take this new income stream by the balls."
He closed one of his hands. He could only make a loose fist because of his arthritis, but I got the idea.
"And I would squeeze."
The look came into his eyes that I sometimes saw, the one that made me glad I wasn't in his bad books. "You'll be around for years yet," I said, blissfully unaware that we were having our last conversation.
"Maybe, or maybe not. But I want to tell you again how glad I am you convinced me to keep this. It's given me something to think about. And when I can't sleep at night, it's been a good companion."
"I'm glad," I said, and I was. "Gotta go. I'll see you tomorrow, Mr. Harrigan." So I did, but he didn't see me. I let myself in through the mudroom door, like always, calling out, "Hi, Mr. Harrigan, I'm here." There was no reply. I decided he was probably in the bathroom. I sure hoped he hadn't fallen in there, because it was Mrs. Grogan's day off. When I went into the living room and saw him sitting in his chair, oxygen bottle on the floor, iPhone and McTeague on the table beside him, I relaxed. Only his chin was on his chest and he had slumped a little to one side. He looked like he was asleep. If so, that was a first this late in the afternoon. He napped for an hour after lunch, and by the time I arrived he was always bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I took a step closer and saw his eyes weren't entirely closed. I could see the lower arc of his irises, but the blue no longer looked sharp. It looked foggy, faded. I began to feel scared. "Mr. Harrigan." Nothing. Gnarled hands folded loosely in his lap. One of his canes was still leaning against the wall, but the other was on the floor, as if he had reached for it and knocked it over. I realized I could hear the steady hiss from the oxygen mask, but not the faint rasp of his breathing, a sound I'd grown so used to that I rarely heard it at all. "Mr. Harrigan, you okay?" I took another couple steps and reached out to shake him awake, then withdrew my hand. I had never seen a dead person, but thought I might be looking at one now. I reached for him again, and this time I didn't chicken out. I grasped his shoulder. It was horribly bony beneath his shirt, and gave him a shake. "Mr. Harrigan, wake up!" One of his hands fell out of his lap and dangled between his legs. He slumped a little farther to one side. I could see the yellowed pegs of his teeth between his lips. Still, I felt I had to be absolutely sure he wasn't just unconscious or in a faint before I called anyone. I had a memory, very brief but very bright, of my mother reading me the story of the little boy who cried wolf. I went into the hall bathroom, the one Mrs. Grogan called the powder room, on legs that felt numb, and came back with the hand mirror Mr. Harrigan kept on the shelf. I held it in front of his mouth and nose. No warm breath misted it. And then I knew, although looking back on it, I'm pretty sure I actually knew when that hand fell out of his lap and hung between his legs. I was in the living room with a dead man, and what if he reached out and grabbed me? Of course he wouldn't do that. He liked me, but I remembered the look he got in his eyes when he said, only yesterday, when he'd been alive, that if he was a younger man, he'd take this new income stream by the balls and squeeze, and how he'd closed his hand into a fist to demonstrate. You'll find many of the opinion that I was ruthless, he'd said. Dead people didn't reach out and grab you except in horror movies, I knew that. Dead people weren't ruthless. Dead people weren't anything. But I still stepped away from him as I took my cell phone out of my hip pocket, and I didn't take my eyes off him when I called my father. Dad said I was probably right, but he'd send an ambulance just in case. Who was Mr. Harrigan's doctor, did I know? I said he didn't have one, and you only had to look at his teeth to know he didn't have a dentist. I said I would wait, and I did, but I did it outside. Before I went, I thought about picking up his dangling hand and putting it back in his lap. I almost did, but in the end I couldn't bring myself to touch it. It would be cold. I took his iPhone instead. It wasn't stealing. I think it was grief, because the loss of him was starting to sink in. I wanted something that was his, something that mattered. I guess that was the biggest funeral our church ever had. Also, the longest cortege to the graveyard, mostly made up of rental cars. There were local people there, of course, including Pete Bostwick, the gardener, and Ronnie Smits, who had done most of the work on his house and gotten wealthy out of it, I'm sure, and Mrs. Grogan, the housekeeper. Other townies as well, because he was well-liked in Harlow. But most of the mourners, if they were mourning and not there just to make sure Mr. Harrigan was really dead, were business people from New York. There was no family. I mean, zero, zilch, nada. Not even a niece or a second cousin. He'd never married, never had kids. Probably one of the reasons Dad was leery about me going up there at first, and he'd outlived all the rest. That's why it was the kid from down the road, the one he paid to come and read to him, who found him. Mr. Harrigan must have known he was on borrowed time, because he left a handwritten sheet of paper on his study desk specifying exactly how he wanted his final rites carried out. It was pretty simple. Hay and Peabody's funeral home had had a cash deposit on their books since 2004, enough to take care of everything with some left over. There was to be no wake or viewing hours, but he wanted to be fixed up decently if possible, so the coffin could be open at the funeral. Reverend Mooney was to conduct the service, and I was to read from the fourth chapter of Ephesians. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you. I saw some of the business types exchange looks at that, as though Mr. Harrigan hadn't shown them a great deal of kindness or much in the way of forgiveness either. He wanted three hymns, Abide with Me, The Old Rugged Cross, and In the Garden. He wanted Reverend Mooney's homily to last no more than 10 minutes, and the Rev finished in just 8, ahead of schedule, and I believe a personal best. Mostly, the Rev just listed all the stuff Mr. Harrigan had done for Harlow, like paying to refurbish the Eureka Grange and fix up the Royal River-covered bridge. He also put the fun drive for the community swimming pool over the top, the Rev said, but refused the naming privilege that went with it. The Rev didn't say why, but I knew. Mr. Harrigan said that allowing people to name things after you was not only absurd, but undignified and ephemeral. In 50 years, he said, or even 20, you were just a name on a plaque that everyone ignored. Once I had done my scriptural duty, I sat in the front row with Dad, looking at the coffin with the vases of lilies at its head and foot. Mr. Harrigan's nose stuck up like the prow of a ship. I told myself not to look at it, not to think it was funny or horrible or both, but to remember him as he'd been. Good advice, but my eyes kept wandering back. When the Rev finished his short talk, He raised his palm-down hand to the assembled mourners and gave the benediction. Once that was done, he said, "Those of you who would like to say a final word of goodbye may now approach the coffin." There was a rustle of clothes and a murmur of voices as people stood. Virginia Hatlin began to play the organ very softly, and I realized, with a strange feeling I couldn't name then but would years later come to identify as surrealism, that it was a medley of country songs, including Ferlin Husky's Wings of a Dove, Dwight Yoakam's I Sang Dixie, and of course, Stand By Your Man. So Mr. Harrigan had even left instructions for the exit music, and I thought, good for him. A line was forming. The locals in their sport coats and khakis, interspersed with the New York types in suits and fancy shoes. "What about you, Craig?" Dad murmured. "Want a last look, or are you good?" I wanted more than that, but I couldn't tell him. The same way I couldn't tell him how bad I felt. It had come home to me now. It didn't happen while I was reading the scripture, as I'd read so many other things for him, but while I was sitting and looking at his nose sticking up, realizing that his coffin was a ship, and it was going to take him on his final voyage, one that went down into the dark. I wanted to cry, and I did cry, but later, in private. I sure didn't want to do it here among strangers. "Yes, but I want to be at the end of the line. I want to be last." My dad, God bless him, didn't ask me why. He just squeezed my shoulder and got into line. I went back to the vestibule, a bit uncomfortable, in a sport jacket that was getting tight around the shoulders because I'd finally started to grow. When the end of the line was halfway down the main aisle, and I was sure no one else was going to join it, I got behind a couple of suited guys who were talking in low tones about, wouldn't you know it, Amazon stock. By the time I got to the coffin, the music had stopped. The pulpit was empty. Virginia Hatlin had probably sneaked out back to have a cigarette, and the Rev would be in the vestry, taking off his robe and combing what remained of his hair. There were a few people in the vestibule, murmuring in low voices, but here in the church it was just me and Mr. Harrigan, as it had been on so many afternoons at his big house on the hill, with its views that were good but not touristy. He was wearing a charcoal gray suit I'd never seen before. The funeral guy had rouged him a little so he'd look healthy, except healthy people don't lie in coffins with their eyes shut and the last few minutes of daylight shining on their dead faces before they go into the earth forever. His hands were folded, making me think of the way they'd been folded when I came into his living room only days before. He looked like a life-sized doll, and I hated seeing him that way. I didn't want to stay. I wanted fresh air. I wanted to be with my father. I wanted to go home. But I had something to do first, and I had to do it right away, because Reverend Mooney could come back from the vestry at any time. I reached into the inside pocket of my sport coat and brought out Mr. Harrigan's phone. The last time I'd been with him, alive, I mean, not slumped in his chair or looking like a doll in an expensive box, he'd said he was glad I'd convinced him to keep the phone. He'd said it was a good companion when he couldn't sleep at night. The phone was password protected. As I've said, he was a fast learner once something really grabbed his interest, but I knew what the password was, Pirate One. I had opened it in my bedroom the night before the funeral and had gone to the notes function. I wanted to leave him a message. I thought about saying, "I love you," but that would have been wrong. I had liked him, certainly, but I'd also been a bit leery of him. I didn't think he loved me either. I don't think Mr. Harrigan ever loved anyone, unless it was the mother who had raised him after his dad left. I had done my research. In the end, the note I typed was this: "Working for you was a privilege. Thank you for the cards and for the scratch-off tickets. I will miss you." I lifted the lapel of his suit coat, trying not to touch the unbreathing surface of his chest beneath his crisp white shirt, but my knuckles brushed it for just a moment. And I can feel that to this day. It was hard, like wood. I tucked the phone into his inside pocket, then stepped away. Just in time, too, Reverend Mooney came out of the side door adjusting his tie.
Saying goodbye, Craig.
Yes. Good. The right thing to do. He slipped an arm around my shoulders and guided me away from the coffin.
You had a relationship with him that I'm sure a great many people would envy. Why don't you go outside now and join your father? And if you want to do me a favor, tell Mr. Rafferty and the other pallbearers that we'll be ready for them in just a few minutes.
Another man had appeared in the door to the vestry, hands clasped before him. You only had to look at his black suit and white carnation to know he was a funeral parlor guy. I suppose it was his job to close the lid of the coffin and make sure it was latched down tight. A terror of death came over me at the sight of him, and I was glad to leave that place and go out into the sunshine. I didn't tell Dad I needed a hug, but he must have seen it because he wrapped his arms around me. Don't die, I thought. Please, Dad, don't die. The service at Elm Cemetery was better because it was shorter and because it was outside. Mr. Harrigan's business manager, Charles Chick Rafferty, spoke briefly about his client's various philanthropies, then got a little laugh when he talked about how he, Rafferty, had to put up with Mr. Harrigan's questionable taste in music. That was really the only human touch Mr. Rafferty managed. He said he'd worked for and with Mr. Harrigan for 30 years, and I had no reason to doubt him, but he didn't seem to know much about Mr. Harrigan's human side other than his questionable taste for singers like Jim Reeves, Patti Loveless, and Hinson Cargill. I thought about stepping forward and telling the people gathered around the open grave that Mr. Harrigan thought the Internet was like a broken water main, spewing information instead of water. I thought of telling them that he had over 100 photos of mushrooms on his phone. I thought of telling them he liked Mrs. Grogan's oatmeal cookies because they always got his bowels in gear, and that when you were in your 80s, you no longer needed to take vitamins or see the doctor. When you were in your 80s, you could eat all the corned beef hash you wanted. But I kept my mouth shut. This time Reverend Mooney read the scripture, the one about how we were all going to rise from the dead like Lazarus on that great getting-up morning. He gave another benediction, and then it was over. After we were gone, back to our ordinary lives, Mr. Harrigan would be lowered into the ground with his iPhone in his pocket, thanks to me, and the dirt would cover him, and the world would see him no more. As Dad and I were leaving, Mr. Rafferty approached us. He said he wasn't flying back to New York until the following morning and asked if he could drop by our house that evening. He said there was something he wanted to talk about with us. My first thought was that it must be about the pilfered iPhone, but I had no idea how Mr. Rafferty could know I'd taken it, and besides, it had been returned to its rightful owner. If he asks me, I thought, I'll tell him I was the one who gave it to him in the first place. And how could a phone that had cost $600 possibly be a big deal when Mr. Harrigan's estate must be worth so much? Sure, Dad said. Come to supper. I make a pretty mean spaghetti bolognese. We usually eat around 6. I'll take you up on that, Mr. Rafferty said. He produced a white envelope with my name on it and handwriting I recognized. This may explain what I want to talk to you about. I received it 2 months ago and was instructed to hold it until... Such an occasion as this. Once we were in our car, Dad burst out laughing, full-throated roars that brought tears to his eyes. He laughed and pounded the steering wheel and laughed and pounded his thigh and wiped his cheeks and then laughed some more. What? I asked when he'd begun to taper off. What's so darn funny? I can't think of anything else it would be, he said. He was no longer laughing, but still chuckling. What the heck are you talking about? I think you must be in his will, Craig. Open that thing. See what it says. There was a single sheet of paper in the envelope, and it was a classic Harrigan communique. No hearts and flowers, not even a deer in the salutation, just straight to business. I read it out loud to my father. Craig, if you're reading this, I've died. I have left you $800,000 in trust. The trustees are your father and Charles Rafferty, who is my business manager, and who will now serve as my executor. I calculate the sum should be sufficient to see you through 4 years of college and any postgraduate work you may choose to do. Enough should remain to give you a start in your chosen career. You spoke of screenwriting. If it's what you want, then of course you must pursue it, but I do not approve. There is a vulgar joke about screenwriters I will not repeat here, but by all means find it on your phone. Keywords, screenwriter, and starlet. There is an underlying truth in it which I believe you will grasp even at your current age. Films are ephemeral, while books, the good ones, are eternal, or close to it. You have read me many good ones, but others are waiting to be written. That is all I will say. Although your father has power of veto in all matters concerning your trust, he would be smart not to exercise it concerning any investments Mr. Rafferty suggests. Chick is wise in the ways of the market. Even with school expenses, your $800,000 may grow to $1 million or more by the time you reach the age of 26, when the trust will expire and you can spend or invest, always the wisest course, as you choose. I have enjoyed our afternoons together. Very truly yours, Mr. Harrigan. P.S. You are most welcome for the cards and the enclosures. That postscript gave me a little shiver. It was almost as if he'd answered the note I'd left on his iPhone when I decided to slip it into the pocket of his burial coat. Dad wasn't laughing or chuckling anymore, but he was smiling. How does it feel to be rich, Greg? It feels okay, I said, and of course it did. It was a great gift, but it was just as good, maybe even better, to realize Mr. Harrigan had thought so well of me. A cynic would probably believe that's me trying to sound saintly or something, but it's not. Because, see, the money was like a frisbee I got stuck halfway up the big pine in our backyard when I was 8 or 9. I knew where it was, but I couldn't get it. And that was okay. For the time being, I had everything I needed. Except for him, that was. What was I going to do with my weekday afternoons now?
I take back everything I ever said about him being a tightwad, Dad said as he pulled out behind a shiny black SUV some business guy had rented at the Portland Jetport. Although
what? I asked.
Considering the lack of relatives and how rich he was, he could have left you at least $4 million. Maybe 6. He saw my look and started laughing again. Joking, kiddo, joking, okay? I punched him on the shoulder and turned on the radio, going past WBLM, Maine's rock and roll blimp, to WTHT, Maine's number one country station. I had gotten a taste for C&W. I have never lost it.
Mr. Rafferty came to dinner and chowed down big on Dad's spaghetti, especially for a skinny guy. I told him I knew about the trust fund and thanked him. He said, "Don't thank me," and told us how he'd like to invest the money. Dad said whatever seemed right, just keep him informed. He did suggest John Deere might be a good place for some of my dough since they were innovating like crazy. Mr. Rafferty said he'd take it under consideration, and I found out later that he did invest in Deere and Company, although only a token amount. Most of it went into Apple and Amazon. After dinner, Mr. Rafferty shook my hand and congratulated me.
Harrigan had very few friends, Craig. You were fortunate to have been one.
And he was fortunate to have Craig, my dad said quietly, and slung an arm around my shoulders. That put a lump in my throat. And when Mr. Rafferty was gone and I was in my room, I did some crying. I tried to keep it quiet so my dad wouldn't hear. Maybe I did. Maybe he heard and knew I wanted to be left alone. When the tears stopped, I turned on my phone, opened Safari, and typed in the keywords screenwriter and starlet. The joke, which supposedly originated with a novelist named Peter Fiebelman, is about a starlet so clueless she fucked the writer. Probably you've heard it. I never had. But I got the point Mr. Harrigan was trying to make. That night, I awoke around 2 o'clock to the sound of distant thunder and realized all over again that Mr. Harrigan was dead. I was in my bed, and he was in the ground. He was wearing a suit, and he would be wearing it forever. His hands were folded and would stay that way until they were just bones. If rain followed the thunder, it might seep down and dampen his coffin. There was no cement lid or liner. He had specified that in what Mrs. Grogan referred to as his dead letter. Eventually, the lid of the coffin would rot. So would the suit. The iPhone, made of plastic, would last much longer than the suit or the coffin, but eventually that would go too. Nothing was eternal, except maybe for the mind of God, and even at 13, I had my doubts about that. All at once, I needed to hear his voice, and I realized I could. It was a creepy thing to do, especially at 2 in the morning, and it was morbid. I knew that, but I also knew that if I did it, I could get back to sleep. So I called and broke out in goose flesh when I realized the simple truth of cell phone technology. Somewhere under the ground in Elm Cemetery, in a dead man's pocket, Tammy Wynette was singing 2 lines of "Stand By Your Man." Then his voice was in my ear, calm and clear, just a bit scratchy with old age. "I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate." And what if he did call back? What if he did? I ended the call even before the beep came and climbed back into bed. As I was pulling the covers up, I changed my mind, got up, and called again. I don't know why. This time I waited for the beep, then said, "I miss you, Mr. Harrigan. I appreciate the money you left me, but I'd give it up to have you still alive." I paused. Maybe that sounds like a lie, but it isn't. It really isn't. Then I went back to bed and was asleep almost as soon as my head hit the pillow. There were no dreams. It was my habit to turn on my phone even before I got dressed and check the Newsy News app to make sure no one had started World War III and there hadn't been any terrorist attacks. Before I could go there on the morning after Mr. Harrigan's funeral, I saw a little red circle on the SMS icon, which meant I had a text message. I assumed it was either from Billy Bogan, a friend and classmate who had a Motorola Ming, or Margie Washburn, who had a Samsung. Although I'd gotten fewer texts from Margie lately, I suppose Regina had blabbed about me kissing her. You know that old saying, "so-and-so's blood ran cold"? That can actually happen. I know, because mine did. I sat on my bed, staring at the screen of my phone. The text was from Pirate King 1. Down in the kitchen, I could hear rattling as Dad pulled the skillet out of the cabinet beside the stove. He was apparently planning to make us a hot breakfast, something he tried to do once or twice a week. "Dad," I said, but the rattling continued, and I heard him say something that might have been, "Come out of there, you damn thing." He didn't hear me, and not just because my bedroom door was closed. I could hardly hear myself. The text had made my blood run cold, and it had stolen my voice. The message above, the most recent one, had been sent 4 days before Mr. Harrigan died. It read, "No need to water the houseplants today. Mrs. G did it." Below it was this: capital C, capital C, capital C, small a. It had been sent at 2:40 a.m. "Dad?" This time it was a little louder, but still not loud enough. I don't know if I was crying then or if the tears started when I was going downstairs still wearing nothing but my underpants and a Gates Falls Tigers t-shirt. Dad's back was to me. He had managed to get the skillet out and was melting butter in it.
He heard me and said, "I hope you're hungry, I know I am."
"Daddy!"
I said, "Daddy!"
He turned when he heard what I'd stopped calling him when I was 8 or 9, saw I wasn't dressed, saw I was crying, saw I was holding out my phone, forgot all about the skillet.
"Craig, what is it? What's wrong? Did you have a nightmare about the funeral?"
It was a nightmare, all right, and probably it was too late. He was old, after all, but maybe it wasn't.
"Oh, Daddy," I said, blubbering now.
"He's not dead. At least he wasn't at 2:30 this morning. We've got to dig him up. We have to because we buried him alive."
I told him everything about how I'd taken Mr. Harrigan's phone and put it in the pocket of his suit coat. Because it came to mean a lot to him, I said, and because it was something I gave him. I told him about calling that phone in the middle of the night, hanging up the first time, then calling back and leaving a message on his voicemail. I didn't need to show Dad the text I got in return because he'd already looked at it, studied it, actually. The butter in the skillet had begun to scorch. Dad got up and moved the skillet off the burner. "Don't suppose you'll be wanting any eggs," he said. Then he came back to the table, but instead of sitting on the other side, in his usual place, he sat next to me and put one of his hands over one of mine. "Listen up now."
"I know it was a creepy thing to do," I said, "but if I hadn't, we never would have known. We have to..."
"Son."
"No, Dad, listen. We have to get somebody out there right away. A bulldozer, a payloader, even guys with shovels. He could still be..."
"Craig, stop. You were spoofed."
I stared at him, my mouth hanging open. I knew what spoofing was, but the possibility that it had happened to me and in the middle of the night had never crossed my mind.
"There's more and more of it going around," he said. "We even had a staff meeting about it at work. Someone got access to Harrigan's cell phone, cloned it. You know what I mean?"
"Yes, sure. But Daddy..."
He squeezed my hand. "Someone hoping to steal business secrets, maybe."
"He was retired."
"But he kept his hand in. He told you that. Or it could have been access to his credit card info they were after. Whoever it was got your voicemail on the cloned phone and decided to play a practical joke."
"You don't know that," I said. "Daddy, we have to check."
"We don't, and I'm going to tell you why. Mr. Harrigan was a rich man who died unattended. In addition to that, he hadn't visited a physician in years, although I bet Rafferty gave him hell on that score. If only because he couldn't update the old guy's insurance to cover more of the death duties. For those reasons, there was an autopsy. That's how they found out he died of advanced heart disease."
"They cut him open?"
I thought of how my knuckles had brushed his chest when I put his phone in his pocket. Had there been stitched-up incisions under his crisp white shirt and knotted tie? If my dad was right, then yes, stitched-up incisions in the shape of a Y. I had seen that on TV, on CSI. "Yes," Dad said. "I don't like telling you that. Don't want it preying on your mind. But it's better that than letting you think he was buried alive. He wasn't. Couldn't have been. He's dead. Do you understand me?"
"Yes."
"Would you like me to stay home today? I will, if you want."
"No. That's okay. You're right. I got spoofed.
And spooked. That too." "What are you going to do with yourself? Because if you're going to brood and be all morbid, I should take the day off. We could go fishing."
"I'm not going to brood and be all morbid, but I should go up to his house and water the plants."
"Is going there a good idea?" He was watching me closely.
"I owe it to him. And I want to talk to Mrs. Grogan, find out if he made a... what you call it for her, too."
"A provision. That's very thoughtful. Of course, she may tell you to mind your beeswax. She's an old-time Yankee, that one."
"If you didn't, I wish I could give her some of mine," I said.
He smiled and kissed my cheek. "You're a good kid. Your mom would be so proud of you. Are you sure you're okay now?"
"Yes."
I ate some eggs and toast to prove it, although I didn't want them.
My dad had to be right. A stolen password.
A cloned phone. A cruel practical joke. It sure hadn't been Mr. Harrigan, whose guts had been tossed like salad and whose blood had been replaced with embalming fluid. Dad went to work, and I went up to Mr. Harrigan's.
Mrs. Grogan was vacuuming the living room. She wasn't singing like she usually did, but she was composed enough, and after I finished watering the plants, she asked if I'd like to go into the kitchen and have a cup of tea, which she called a cup of cheer, with her. "There's cookies, too," she said. We went into the kitchen, and while she boiled the kettle, I told her about Mr. Harrigan's note and how he'd left money in trust for my college education. Mrs. Grogan nodded in businesslike fashion, as if she'd expected no less, and said she had also gotten an envelope from Mr. Rafferty.
"The boss fixed me up. More than I expected. Probably more than I deserve."
I said I felt pretty much the same way. Mrs. G. brought the tea to the table, a big mug for each of us. Between them, she set down a plate of oatmeal cookies.
"He loved these," Mrs. Grogan said.
"Yeah, he said they got his bowels in gear." That made her laugh. I picked up one of the cookies and bit into it. As I chewed, I thought of the scripture from 1 Corinthians I'd read at Methodist Youth Fellowship on Maundy Thursday and at Easter service just a few months back. "And when he had given thanks, he brake it and said, 'Take, eat. This is my body, which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me.'" The cookies weren't communion. The Rev would surely have called the idea blasphemous, but I was glad to have one just the same. "He took care of Pete, too," she said, meaning Pete Bostwick, the gardener. "Nice," I said, and reached for another cookie. "He was a good guy, wasn't he?"
"Not so sure about that," she said. "He was square dealing, all right, but you didn't want to be on his bad side. You don't remember Dusty Bilodeau, do you?" "No, you wouldn't. He was before your time."
"From the Bilodeaus over in the trailer park?"
"Eh, yeah." "That's right. Next to the store. But I expect Dusty isn't among 'em. He'll have gone on his merry way long since. He was the gardener before Pete, but wasn't 8 months on the job before Mr. Harrigan caught him stealing and fired his butt. I don't know how much he got or how Mr. Harrigan found out, but firing didn't end it. I know you know some of the stuff Mr. H gave this little town and all the ways he helped out, but Mooney didn't tell even half of it, maybe because he didn't know or maybe because he was on a timer. Charity is good for the soul, but it also gives a man power, and Mr. Harrigan used his on Dusty Bilodeau." She shook her head, partly, I think, in admiration. She had that Yankee hard streak in her. "I hope he filched at least a few hundred out of Mr. Harrigan's desk or sock drawer or wherever, because that was the last money he ever got in the town of Harlow, county of Castle, state of Maine. He couldn't have landed a job shoveling hen shit out of old Dorrance Ma Stella's barn after that. Mr. Harrigan saw to it. He was a square-dealing man, but if you weren't the same, God help you. Have another cookie."
I took another cookie.
"And drink your tea, boy."
I drank my tea.
"I guess I'll do the upstairs next. Probably change the sheets on the beds instead of just stripping 'em, at least for now. What do you think's going to happen with this house?"
"Gee, I don't know."
"Neither do I. Not a clue. Can't imagine anyone buying it. Mr. Harrigan was one of a kind, and that goes the same for..."
She spread her arms wide.
"All this."
I thought about the glass elevator and decided she had a point. Mrs. G. grabbed another cookie.
"What about the house plants? Any ideas about them?"
"I'll take a couple if it's all right," I said. "The rest, I don't know."
"Me either. His freezer's full. I guess we could split that three ways. You, me, and Pete."
"Take, eat," I thought. "This do in remembrance of me." She sighed.
"I'm mostly just dithering, stretching out a few chores like they were many. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, and that's the God's honest. What about you, Craig? What are you going to do?"
"Right now I'm going downstairs to spritz his hen of the woods," I said. "And if you're sure it's okay, I'll at least take the African violet when I go home."
course I'm sure, she said it the Yankee way. Course. As many as you want.
She went upstairs and I down to the basement where Mr. Harrigan kept his mushrooms and a bunch of terrariums. While I spritzed, I thought about the text message I'd gotten from Pirate King One in the middle of the night. Dad was right. It had to be a joke. But wouldn't a practical joker have sent something at least half-witty, like, save me, I'm trapped in a box, or the old one that went, don't bother me while I'm decomposing? Why would a practical joker just send a double A, which when you spoke it, sounded kind of like a gurgle or a death rattle? And why would a practical joker send my initial, not once or twice, but three times? I ended up taking four of Mr. Harrigan's houseplants, the African violet, the anthurium, the peperomia, and the Dieffenbachia. I spotted them around our house, saving the Dieffenbachia for my room, because it was my favorite. But I was just marking time, and I knew it. Once the plants were placed, I got a bottle of Snapple out of the fridge, put it in the saddlebag of my bike, and rode out to Elm Cemetery. It was deserted on that hot summer forenoon, and I went right to Mr. Harrigan's grave. The stone was in place, nothing fancy, just a granite marker with his name and dates on it. There were plenty of flowers, all still fresh, that wouldn't last long, most with cards tucked in them. The biggest bunch, perhaps picked from Mr. Harrigan's own flower beds, and out of respect, not parsimony, was from Pete Bostwick's family. I got down on my knees, but not to pray. I took my phone out of my pocket and held it in my hand. My heart was beating so hard it made little black dots flash in front of my eyes. I went to my contacts and called him. Then I lowered my phone, put the side of my face down on the newly replaced sod, listening for Tammy Wynette. I thought I heard her, too. But it must have been my imagination. It would have had to have come through his coat, through the lid of his coffin, and up through 6 feet of ground. But I thought I did. No, check that. I was sure I did. Mr. Harrigan's phone singing, "Stand by your man," down there in his grave. In my other ear, the one not pressed to the ground, I could hear his voice, very faint but audible in the dozing stillness of that place. I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate. But he wouldn't, appropriate or not. He was dead. I went home. In September of 2009, I started school at Gates Falls Middle along with my friends Margie, Regina, and Billy. We rode in a little used bus, which quickly earned us the jeering nickname of Short Bus Kids from the Gates Kids. I eventually got taller, although I stopped 2 inches short of 6 feet, which sort of broke my heart. But on that first day of school, I was the shortest kid in the eighth grade, which made me a perfect target for Kenny Yanko, a hulking troublemaker who had been kept back that year, and whose picture should have been in the dictionary next to the word bully. Our first class wasn't a class at all, but a school assembly for the new kids from the so-called tuition towns of Harlow, Motton, and Shiloh Church. The principal that year, and for many years to come, was a tall, shambling fellow with a bald head so shiny it looked Simonized. This was Mr. Albert Douglas, known to the kids as either Alky Al or Dipso Doug. None of the kids had ever actually seen him loaded, but it was an article of faith back then that he drank like a fish. He took the podium, welcomed this group of fine new students to Gates Falls Middle, and told us about all the wonderful things that awaited us in the coming academic year. These included band, glee club, debate club, photography club, Future Farmers of America, and all the sports we could handle as long as they were baseball, track, soccer, or lacrosse. There would be no football option until high school.
He explained about dress-up Fridays once a month, when boys would be expected to wear ties and sport jackets, and girls would be expected to wear dresses. No hems more than 2 inches above the knee, please. Last of all, he told us there was to be absolutely no initiations of the new out-of-town students. Us, in other words. Apparently, the year before, a transfer student from Vermont had wound up in Central Maine General after being forced to chug-a-lug 3 bottles of Gatorade, and now the tradition had been banned. Then he wished us well and sent us off on what he called our academic adventure. My fears about getting lost in this huge new school turned out to be groundless, because it really wasn't huge at all. All my classes except for Period 7 English were on the second floor, and I liked all my teachers. I had been scared of math class, but it turned out we were picking up pretty much where I'd left off, so that was okay. I was feeling pretty good about the whole thing until the 4-minute change of classes between Period 6 and Period 7. I headed down the hall to the stairs, past slamming lockers, gabbing kids, and the smell of beefaroni from the cafeteria. I had just reached the top of the stairs when a hand grabbed me. "Hey, new boy, not so fast." I turned and saw a 6-foot troll with an acne-blasted face. His black hair hung down to his shoulders in greasy clumps. Small dark eyes peered out at me from beneath a protruding shelf of forehead. They were filled with bogus merriment. He was wearing stovepipe jeans and scuffed biker boots. In one hand, he held a paper bag. "Take it." Clueless, I took it. Kids were hurrying past me and down the stairs, some with quick sideways glances at the kid with the long black hair. "Look inside." I did. There was a rag, a brush, and a can of kiwi boot polish. I tried to hand the bag back. "I have to get to class." "Uh-uh, new boy. Not until you shine my boots." Clueless no more. It was an initiation stunt, and although expressly forbidden by the principal just that morning, I thought about doing it. Then I thought about all the kids hurrying downstairs past us. They would see the little country boy from Harlow on his knees with that rag and brush and can of polish. The story would spread fast. Yet I still might have done it, because this kid was much bigger than I was, and I didn't like the look in his eyes. "I would love to beat the shit out of you," that look said. "Just give me an excuse, new boy." Then I thought of what Mr. Harrigan would think if he ever saw me down on my knees, humbly shining this oaf's shoes. "No," I said. "No's a mistake you don't want to make," the kid said. "You better fucking believe it."
"Boys, say boys, is there a problem here?"
It was Ms. Hargensen, my earth science teacher. She was young and pretty, couldn't have been long out of college, but she had an air of confidence about her that said she took no shit. The big boy shook his head. "No problem here." "All good," I said, handing the bag back to its owner.
"What's your name?"
Miss Hargensen asked. She wasn't looking at me.
"Kenny Yanko."
"And what's in your bag, Kenny?"
"Nothing."
"It wouldn't be an initiation kit, would it?"
"No," he said. "I gotta go to class."
I did too. The crowd of kids going downstairs was thinning out, and pretty soon the bell was going to ring.
"I'm sure you do, Kenny. But one more second."
She switched her attention to me.
"Craig, right?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"What's in that bag, Craig? I'm curious."
I thought of telling her. Not out of any Boy Scout honesty is the best policy bullshit, but because he had scared me and now I was pissed off, and, might as well admit it, because I had an adult here to run interference. Then I thought, how would Mr. Harrigan handle this? Would he snitch?
"The rest of his lunch," I said. "Half a sandwich. He asked me if I wanted it."
If she had taken the bag and looked inside, we both would have been in trouble. But she didn't, although I bet she knew. She just told us to get to class and went clicking away
on her medium, just right for school heels. I started down the stairs, and Kenny Yanko grabbed me again.
You should have shined him, new boy.
That pissed me off more.
I just saved your ass. You should be saying thank you.
He flushed, which did not compliment all those erupting volcanoes on his face.
You should have shined him.
He started away, then turned back, still holding his stupid paper bag.
Fuck your thanks, new boy, and fuck you.
A week later, Kenny Yanko got into it with Mr. Arsenal, the woodshop teacher, and hucked a hand sander at him. Kenny had had no less than 3 suspensions during his 2 years at Gates Falls Middle. After my confrontation with him at the top of the stairs, I found out he was sort of a legend, and that was the last straw. He was expelled, and I thought my problems with him were over. Like most small-town schools, Gates Falls Middle was very big on traditions. Dress-up Fridays was just one of many. There was carrying the boot, which meant standing in front of the IGA and asking for contributions to the fire department, and doing the mile, running around the gym 20 times in phys ed, and singing the school song at the monthly assemblies. Another of these traditions was the autumn dance, a Sadie Hawkins kind of deal where the girls were supposed to ask the boys. Margie Washburn asked me, and of course I said yes, because I wanted to go on being friends with her even though I didn't like her, you know, that way. I asked my dad to drive us, which he was more than happy to do. Regina Michaels asked Billy Bogan, so it was a double date. It was especially good because Regina whispered to me in study hall that she'd only asked Billy because he was my friend. I had a hell of a good time until the first intermission, when I left the gym to offload some of the punch I'd put away. I got as far as the boys' room door, then someone seized me by the belt with one hand and the back of my neck with the other, and propelled me straight down the hall to the side exit that gave onto the faculty parking lot. If I hadn't put out a hand to shove the crash bar, Kenny would have run me into the door face first. I have total recall of what followed. I have no idea why the bad memories of childhood and early adolescence are so clear. I only know they are, and this is a very bad memory. The night air was shockingly cold after the heat of the gym, not to mention the humidity exuded by all those adolescent fruiting bodies. I could see moonlight gleaming on the chrome of the 2 parked cars belonging to that night's chaperones, Mr. Taylor and Ms. Hargensen. New teachers got stuck chaperoning because it was, you guessed it, a GFMS tradition. I could hear exhaust banging away through some car's shot muffler up on Highway 96, and I could feel the hot, raw scrape of my palms when Kenny Yanko pushed me down on the parking lot pavement. "Now get up," he said. "You got a job to do." I got up. I looked at my palms and saw they were bleeding. There was a bag sitting on one of the parked cars. He took it and held it out. "Shine my boots. Do that, and we'll call it square." "Fuck you," I said, and punched him in the eye. Total recall, okay? I can remember every time he hit me. 5 blows in all. I can remember how the last one drove me back against the cinder block wall of the building and how I told my legs to hold me up and they declined. I just slid slowly down until my butt was on the macadam. I can remember the black-eyed peas, faint but audible, doing boom, boom, pow. I can remember Kenny standing over me, breathing hard and saying, "Tell anyone and you're dead." But of all the things I can remember, the one I recall best and treasure is the sublime and savage satisfaction I felt when my fist connected with his face. It was only when I got in, but it was a hell of a shot. Boom.